Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and this is The Current.
Every night, every day, I think only about that moment when he collapsed on the floor. He probably called for me, but I could do nothing for him. My wife, his mother, still lives, but she's mentally damaged since the day Fabio left us. She cries all day.
That's Justino Giselmo. He is 88 now, and he's talking about his son Fabio. On September 4th of 1997, Fabio Giselmo bled to death in the lobby of the Hotel Copacabana in Havana, Cuba. A bomb had been placed in an ashtray near where he was sitting. The resulting explosion shot a shard of glass right into his neck. That explosion was part of a string of bombings that hit Cuba throughout 1997. They targeted hotels, resorts, and bars frequented by tourists. Keith Bolander, traveled to Cuba to meet with Justino Giselmo, as well as others who had their own stories to tell about a decades-long series of aggressive acts against Cuban civilians. The result is a book called Voices from the Other Side, an oral history of terrorism against Cuba. Keith Bolander is in Toronto. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, we just heard the father of Fabio talking about losing his son. What more can you tell us about that specific bombing?
Well, the bombing was part of a campaign that occurred during a few months in 1997 that was specifically targeted against hotel facilities and tourist facilities in Cuba. A number of hotels were bombed, including the Copacabana, the most famous Havana cafe, the Bodeguita del Medio, was bombed as well. And it was part of a campaign to try and discourage tourists, and in fact, Canadian tourists, from coming to Cuba as the Cuban government was opening up the tourist industry following the fall of the Soviet Union in the late 90s. They were looking for ways to increase the economy, and they turned to tourism.
In fact, the Canadian government at the time was warning Canadians to be careful because of these bombings.
Very much so. There were specific warnings to tourists, and at that time, the Canadian tourism was the highest level of tourists coming to Cuba, which still is. And so there were warnings a few years previously, and they were specifically aimed at Canadian tourists not to come to Cuba.
Was anyone arrested, convicted for that bombing?
Well, yes, there was. There was a Salvadorian, Raul Cruz Leon, who was convicted of that specific bombing, as well as a number of other bombings that took place in Havana. He was arrested, convicted, sentenced to death. That death sentence has been commuted. And at that time, he confessed, he testified that one of the organizers of the campaign was Luis Posada Carriles, who has been involved, allegedly been involved, so claims the Cuban government, in a number of other terrorist activities.
Okay, well, and we're going to talk about him later because there's several that you raise in your book. But let's go back to the Copacabana bombing. You sought out Fabio Giselmo's father, Justino. He talked to you. What did he tell you?
Well, it was very emotional. He had been involved in Cuba on a business level for a number of years, and his son, Fabio, was starting to get involved in Cuba as well, based on his father's encouragement. And after it was funny. It was such a tragic situation. The bomb exploded in the hotel lobby. Fabio was the only person in the lobby, and that shard of glass that hit him, if it had been a quarter of an inch either way, he would have survived. He was
totally the random freak thing.
Absolutely incredible. It just hit him in the exact spot where he bled to death, and he was the only fatality in this string of bombs. There was a number of injuries, but he was the only fatality. And Justino talked about what a wonderful person his son was. He was involved in soccer. He wanted to open an Italian restaurant in Havana. And the Cuban government, after Fabio's death, asked the father what were Fabio's dreams, and the two dreams were to open the restaurant and to bring his Italian soccer team to play some games in Havana. Well, after Fabio's death, the father actually did open a restaurant in Havana named after his son. A year later, the soccer team from Italy did come down to Cuba to play some exhibition games.
So the father has stayed in Cuba. He was going back and forth, but now he stayed because of what happened to his son there.
He is a full-time resident in Cuba. He is the owner-operator of Fabio Restaurant in Havana, and he says he will die in Cuba.
That's it's interesting what one's grief has one do. Huh? So that's related to that.
It affected him that way, and it affected his wife in an entirely different way. She just couldn't cope with it, and she's had mental problems ever since.
So has she stayed in Cuba as well?
Or? No, she did not.
Interesting.
She stayed in Italy. She could not come back to Cuba. The memories were too painful.
You use the word terrorism in your title. How do you define terrorism?
Well, specifically, I define it based on the State Department's definition.
U.S. State Department.
The U.S. State Department definition of it. And it's based on the fact that there are violent acts specifically aimed against civilians with the purpose of trying to change the political system of a specific country or entity. So the book limited itself to interviews of victims from Cuban civilians. I did not interview officials, government officials. There was bombs placed in a number of Cuban offices, embassies and consulate general offices. I did not interview those people. I specifically restricted it to Cuban civilians.
Okay. One of the most notorious acts against Cuban civilians that you explore is the downing of Cubana Airlines Flight 455. The date was October 6th, 1976. 73 people on board, all killed. Two bombs brought down that plane. What happened?
That, again, comes back into the territory of Luis Posada Carriles. He and Orlando Bosch are the recognized international masterminds of this act. The plane was coming back from Barbados. They had stopped in Venezuela. On board was a group of the Cuban national fencing team that had just won a gold medal in Venezuela, and they were coming back celebrating this event. The evidence indicates that there was two Venezuelans hired by Posada Carriles and Orlando Bosch to plant bombs in the plane. At that time, the security for airlines was much less as it is now after 9/11, so it was not a difficult task for them to do it. The plane took off from Barbados after just only a few minutes. The two bombs exploded, destroying the plane completely. Only a few bodies were recovered. And to this day, it remains the second worst act of air terrorism in the Americas after 9/11.
Oh, that's right, because Air India, though the bomb was placed here, actually blew up over the UK, off the coast of Ireland, yeah. Now, you mentioned Posada Carriles and Orlando Bosch, but there were two guys on that plane who actually got off the plane. And they were then charged and convicted of that bombing.
Well, those were the two Venezuelans, Freddy Lugo and Hernan Ricardo, who physically planted the bombs on the plane. They got off. The plane exploded. The authorities checked the manifesto and saw that these two had just left the plane. They were on their way back to Venezuela when they were arrested. They were arrested. They confessed. Their testimony indicated the culpability of Bosch and Posada Carriles. They were arrested as well. They went through a trial, a military trial. There was no convictions on that. That was changed to a civilian trial. The two Venezuelans who planted the bombs were convicted and served about 20 years. Orlando Bosch got off on a technicality. Luis Posada Carriles was convicted, and he was in jail waiting for final sentencing when he escaped Venezuelan jail.
Isn't he up for trial again somewhere?
Yes, this week, this coming week, I'm going to be in El Paso. He is being tried in El Paso for his illegal entry back into the United States in 2005. And there is a public forum on Sunday regarding his history of terrorism activities.
Well, let's talk about him for a minute, because the allegation is that he was trained by the CIA, is it not?
Yeah, it's quite common knowledge that he was involved in the CIA for a number of years. He was involved in the Bay of Pigs. He was involved in Iran-Contra. He has a number of years' experience under CIA tutelage.
And didn't he also give an interview to the New York Times where he suggested as much?
Yeah, and it's the charges in El Paso are obstruction of justice, perjury, and immigration fraud. And part of the perjury charge relates to when he was talking to the American immigration officials. He apparently didn't tell them the whole truth how he got back in the United States. At the same time, they asked him about his involvement in this 1997 bombing campaign, and he refused to acknowledge any participation in it whatsoever. Now, this contradicts the stories that the New York Times wrote about him a few years previously, where he admitted that he was deeply involved in it. So the perjury charge is sort of based on his testimony to the immigration officials on how he came back into the United States, as well as indirectly his participation in the bombings. Now, he is not being charged for any terrorist activities.
Okay, so that basically gives us the backstory on the guy who's believed to be the mastermind. But let's go back to the people on that flight, because you interviewed the daughter of the co-pilot on that flight. And we've got part of that interview and the audio that exists from the cockpit as her father and the flight's captain realize that there is an explosion and a fire on the plane. Let's listen to that.
Many people in the world are unaware of the sabotage in Barbados. People know September 11th, but they do not know that in Cuba we had our September 11th a long time ago, before they did.
Your father's voice was recorded when the plane...
We had an explosion and we were descended immediately. We had fire on board.
You went off fire, we returned to the field.
Okay, see what Giovanna Force 5-5. We requested immediately landing.
Giovanna Force 5-5, you are clear to land.
Roger. Cierra la puerta, cierra la puerta!
My father's words are, pelo, pelo, stick to the water. That recording continues to haunt me. They broadcast it on TV constantly, and for me it's torture. They are desperately trying to fight for their lives, and it causes me to feel that I'm reliving it over and over again. I'd like them to erase it or mute it, and that it never be heard again.
Okay, that last voice in translation is Jaimel Espinoza Gomez. Her father, Miguel, was the co-pilot of Cabana Airlines Flight 455. And Keith Bolander, we can hear him panicking there, or at least, you know, the adrenaline in his voice as the plane is going down. She says that the audio from that cockpit is aired on television in Cuba constantly. Why is that?
That is the most famous audio tape heard in Cuba relating to this incident. Every anniversary, they play that tape. The Cuban government does mark it as a significant date in the history. There, a week after the incident, there was a huge memorial event in Havana where 1 million people showed up. So every year, it is constantly played, and then the Cuban government uses it throughout the year as well when they're speaking to the history of terrorism against their country. So it's on the radio, it's on the television, and as Jaimel explained, every time she hears it, it has such a personal impact on her. It brings back all the memories, which was a consistent theme throughout the interviews. These people would remember the acts as it happened yesterday, regardless if it happened 30 or 40 years ago.
It's interesting. So they are constantly reminded, and that's a government decision, obviously, to keep playing this. But this is right off our radar everywhere else.
It's a huge topic in Cuba. You can't speak to almost anyone in Cuba without them having some contact directly or indirectly with someone who has been affected by these acts of terrorism. Outside of Cuba, it's almost completely unknown, which was sort of part of the reason why I wanted to do the book, to let the reader outside of Cuba understand that you know, terrorism sometimes works on a two-way street.
You talk about people and talk to people who are targeted by what you call biological terrorism, biological warfare. What was going on?
Well, this happened in the early 1980s. There was a string of diseases that the Cuban government claims were introduced intentionally by outside forces, and they
like what?
Like dengue 2, botulism, tobacco plague, sugarcane rust, a whole series. And the Cuban government brought in international experts from the United Nations and the United States who examined these cases. And they came to the conclusion that they were not introduced, they were not a natural situation, that they were introduced intentionally. And the most impactful one was dengue 2.
What is that?
It's hemorrhagic dengue. It's the most viral form of dengue. It is often fatal and, in fact, killed over 100 children in Cuba. And the case was really quite interesting. In a period of just a few months, there was almost a 500,000 cases of dengue 2 through a straight line from one side of the island of Cuba to the other. And these experts from the United Nations and international, including Americans, said this just doesn't occur naturally. It had to be introduced. Now, dengue 2 is introduced through the use of mosquitoes. And one of there was a Cuban American, Eduardo Erosena, who was head of one of the anti-government organizations, Omega 7, who testified that he was hired to introduce a number of biological agents into Cuba, one of which was dengue 2.
So I was just going to ask you, who was behind this stuff then?
Well,
like, what's the belief?
The Cuban government claims, and there is some substantial evidentiary documentation to back it up, that most of these acts were in the early years were conducted by the U.S. government, like Operation Mongoose under the auspices of the State Department and the CIA. After that, anti-revolutionary organizations in Florida sort of took over the actions directly against Cuba, including the biological.
So the belief is they were funded by the U.S. government?
That's part of the claim that the Cuban government makes, that a lot of the funding came from the Cuban government or through organizations that were indirectly funded by the Cuban government.
And by the American government.
By the American government, thank you.
And has that ever been proven?
Well, there's evidence from Cuban Americans like Eduardo Erosena. Luis Posada Carriles claimed in the article
that he was a beneficiary.
Exactly. So, I mean, direct evidence, no, but circumstantial and documentary evidence, there is some.
Okay, and again, in terms of biological agents, the allegation is that they were sprayed. Like you said, they went in a line with dengue 2. The allegation is they somehow dropped something from a plane in a line?
Yeah, the claim
like mosquitoes?
Is... Exactly.
What?
The claim is exactly that. There was a small plane that came from South Florida that overflew Cuban airspace and dropped these mosquitoes, because if you look at the history of it, it was in a remarkably straight line. And at one point, the Cuban government was reporting 10 to 15,000 cases of dengue 2 per week within a 2 or 3 month period. And again, getting back to the experts, they said this just doesn't happen naturally.
Interesting. I want to talk about something else now. I have a piece of tape from archival news footage that goes back to March of 1960.
A French munition ship, La Cobra, blazes at dockside in Havana after an explosion during the unloading of her cargo of small arms ammunition that rocked the harbor. The blast hurled a fiery rain of steel over a wide area, taking a toll of lives that may amount to 100. Over 200 more were injured. Fidel Castro proclaimed a public funeral ceremony for the blast victims and cried sabotage, charging United States implication. Secretary of State Herter personally launched a strong protest against these unfounded charges. As Cuba mourned her dead, a new mirage was mounting between Havana and Washington.
I thought those headline stories were from the 40s. That was the 1960s. Interesting. La Cobra, the name of a French vessel, arrived in Havana from Belgium, loaded with munitions. This was the time around the revolution, right? What's going on?
This was about a year after the revolution. I'd never heard that tape. It was quite interesting to hear it. It was a French vessel loaded with Belgian munitions. And it was one of the few...
What, that the Cubans had bought?
Yes, the Cubans had bought. And it was one of the few munition ships that were... were allowed to come into Cuba. The American government was exerting tremendous pressure on other countries not to sell weapons to Cuba. And this was before the Soviet Union had full relations with Cuba, and the Cubans were buying arms from the Soviet Union. So the Cuban government was looking to purchase arms. The American government was refusing to sell them. And so this was one of the very few ships that had munitions that was coming into Cuba. Now, the Cuban government claims it was sabotaged. Prior to arriving in Havana, it stayed in Miami for 3 days. And the Cuban government claims at that point, anti-government organizers planted two bombs on that ship.
You talked to a man who was actually there.
Yeah, a number of people who survived the explosion were interviewed in the book, and it was one of the most dramatic stories because they were all together in one room and they worked off on each other, and the emotions were extremely high. This one story in particular, this man, he was just in the neighborhood. It was in Old Havana, the port of Old Havana. The first explosion took place. He rushed to the scene to see what was happening, as hundreds of other Cubans did. He was coordinating the operations. He was taking hand grenades off the ship. They were loaded on a truck, and he was going to push this truck into the water. The second explosion hit, and it's been described as like a nuclear blast, and that was the one that killed over 100 people and injured hundreds other. Just prior to that, there was three Cuban officials who came to the scene just before the second explosion.
Who were they?
Fidel Castro, Raul Castro, and Che Guevara, and they came to see what was going on. Well, this person told them to leave the area immediately because of the danger. Well, 5 or 10 minutes later, the second explosion hit. One piece of debris came down, cut off his right leg. He did survive it, but it was an incredible scene, and there's still a monument there. And the Cuban government to this day claims it was an act of sabotage.
It's so interesting. It would have changed Cuban history again if those three had been killed in that as well.
Somewhat.
Any chance that you see relations improving under Obama with the U.S. and the Cuban Americans?
Well, there was a lot of expectation when President Obama came into office that he was, because he had said a number of things prior indicating that American policy was a failure, things needed to be changed. So the Cuban government was quite enthusiastic about the possibility of change. He did a major move. He allowed Cuban Americans to come to Cuba without restrictions. Since then, he's done nothing, and there's been a great deal of disappointment.
Keith Bolander, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Keith Bolander is the author of Voices from the Other Side, an oral history of terrorism against Cuba.